Hey, this is Curious John, and I am sitting here with Morgan Lesko of WikiWorldOrder.com and formerly of Students for SensibleDrugPolicy.org, and also has another site, AltBib, that's A-L-T-B-I-B.com. And we were getting into talking about web stuff and the future of technology and humanity and everything, and I asked him if his perspective was pessimistic or optimistic, and the conversation started getting interesting, so we'll put it here for you to listen to. So are you pessimistic or optimistic about the future?
Well, the short answer is I'm more optimistic every day and every month, and I have been, at least since I've started getting like more vocal and active on the deeper issues I was most pessimistic about. Mm-hmm. And what I started telling you was how I sent a letter to 40 of my closest friends and family about, you know, my more radical ideas, and the only two that knew what I was talking about were also optimistic. They said, "Oh, I know what you're talking about, man, but don't worry, we're gonna win." And as depressing like as it was in one sense that so few of my friends like were aware of information that was so important and alarming to me, the ones that did were optimistic, and that ever since then I was on a, and just expressing myself about it more helped me just get more optimistic every day, and now I feel like the wave is coming. I feel the wave now, you know.
I kind of go back and forth, but I think overall pretty optimistic. So what, when you say when, against who and what? And what are those issues that only two of your friends had heard about?
The specific issues that I was most upset to not see on programs like Democracy Now, which, you know, one of my favorites, were the 9/11 truth issues, as they're called. And ever since, you know, watching Building 7 fall at free fall speed, it just never made any sense to me, and I couldn't leave the physics. Like the physics of especially that building, but all three buildings allowed me to never leave the topic. And the amount of silence surrounding it was like upsetting. And I was hoping it was eight crazy Bush years, you know. And I was living in D.C. for most of them, and everybody there was just depressed as all hell, you know. And I thought it'd be different when Obama took over, you know, at least on some level. I knew by then it was like a lot of puppet, you know, left-right BS. But, you know, I thought there'd be at least some, you know, a constitutional lawyer. But a couple months in, he defends rendition in front of the Constitution and the National Archives, and like, done, crossed the final line. Like, it's really early, too bad. And so I was, you know, then I was just really concerned that people were, you know, going to get passive because a safe, you know, brilliant, beautiful man was in office, you know, that people would get passive. And I'm glad to see, like, Occupy has been such a relief to my optimism. You know, that's mm-hmm. boosted it infinitely, even though
there's a lot of activity that's, movement that's come out of that. And I think, yeah, even now, in, you know, almost a year later, what we've seen is a lot of folks within the movement who it mobilized mm-hmm. have now moved away from physical occupation and are busy within their little local networks mm-hmm. building communities and building mm-hmm. resilience and yeah. working on tech projects. And mm-hmm. I mean, like, the media has decided to really stop covering things at all because yeah. they, you know, that's the strategy, just go
Such
silent.
Such a different form now.
And then the mainstream just kind of thinks, oh, nothing's happening. There's so much happening. So my question for you is, when you say when, I mean, what do you envision winning against what, and what makes you optimistic about us or humanity winning, I mean? Broadly and specifically.
Yeah, specifically, I'd say I think I still can simplify best by like an open source, transparent paradigm, you know, which is I think inherently non-hierarchical, and values honesty over other qualities, you know, just in terms of systems. But like I see those as like crucial components to like any resulting systems from any resulting transitions. But in the broad sense, in terms of like winning, I guess one of the most core themes that I think is least describable in terms of these alternative analyses and history is this pattern of predation and consolidation of power, you know, over you know all of human history, all written history, you know. And so in my mind, the big game is how do we end that cycle, and how does whatever system comes out, you know, be in the hands of the 100%, and instead of a 1%, like it's always been throughout history. So I'm very concerned about the losses in those transitions because of, you know, all the pessimistic versions of the future, you know, like, which are, you know, as rational to be concerned about as anything else described by anyone, you know, like, so it's frustrating, but like, I think that's the big game in my mind, you know, and you know, those families, I guess, you know, there are probably families that can be named and families that can't, you know, and that's a gray area that I, you know, I've limited interest in trying to hunt down and figure out, you know. It's the big principles and big solutions I'm more interested in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the globe really has quite a concentrated power. And with 7 billion of us climbing towards 9 in 50 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And we're pushing a lot of the global systems to their limits in mm-hmm. terms of ecologically and agriculturally and mm-hmm. economically and politically. I mean, like, there's just so many ways that we're really coming towards this climactic kind of breaking point.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm seeing is we're moving to either transition into a very new way of doing things, mm-hmm. and that's going to be more decentralized power and more peer-to-peer agency mm-hmm. amongst people and sovereignty over their networks and connections and local resilient mm-hmm. lives, and that's what I would hope to see.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, so I have optimism that if we make the right moves now, we can achieve that. But what I also, like, on the other end, fear is this imminent collapse. I feel mm-hmm. like the rate at which things are changing, on just the technological side, mm-hmm. the advancements in robotics and automation,
mm-hmm.
it's going to put millions of would-be workers out of work,
mm-hmm.
and that we don't have these resilient networks established. I mean, we're so dependent on the existing system and infrastructure that what happens when that gets swept out of it from under everyone's feet overnight? I mean, it's mm-hmm. coming very quickly, and I don't think very many people are prepared. Even on an education level,
mm-hmm.
people aren't multidisciplinary enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They can't learn and relearn mm-hmm. the types of traits that are relevant for a modern, like, information economy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's happening. That's what we're going through right now, is a shift to an information economy and
totally.
An information world.
Totally.
So yeah, I'm with you in optimism.
Yeah,
but, like,
yeah.
I dream of a future when humans, by and large, are liberated from meaningless work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we're liberated mm-hmm. and free to explore what we're here to explore, which our connection with each other and with our advancement of arts and science mm-hmm. and expression through art. But at the same time, I'm concerned about what's going to happen in the transition to getting to that place. And I see potential solutions cropping up from everywhere.
Mm-hmm,
and there are
mm-hmm.
things that give me hope, but I still have that side of me that's quite worried.
Yeah, me too. Me too. And that, yeah, I definitely, I mean, I described it to my parents, you know, because they were like, they were, and my ex-girlfriend were the first people that I had to, you know, try to talk to about these rabbit holes, you know? And
when you say rabbit hole, what do you mean?
Just alternative explanations for current and past events and realities.
We have the written history and real history, and it's been proven over and over that that's totally...
Yes.
You know, one's over here, one's way over here, and that's happened for all of history.
Yeah, the Earth was definitely flat once, you know, definitely, but...
So, can you tell me really quick, what is Wiki World Order, and what are you trying to do with it?
Well, Wiki World Order was my goal was to focus on the solutions, because I felt like there was a lot of good, you know, at least thorough information on the problems, and a lot of more people were waking up, and I felt that exponential curve growing just with the growth of the internet, pretty much. And then I wanted to focus on the solutions, and also just like try. I told myself that I wanted to bridge the gap between Alex Jones and Rachel Maddow. So that was like sort of my loose goal. Like, if I can get like people who go to Rachel Maddow first to like tolerate and like consider a few of these radical ideas, like, I'll be really happy. But as Occupy began, then it really, you know, I got to try a totally different style of documenting my participation in what I felt was and is a more physical representation of this online, like, information revolution, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like the physical reality spillover of our virtual revolution, you know, in so many ways. And now I'm at the point where I sort of need a break, and I need to recenter myself a little bit and just plan some next steps. And I'm also feeling like art is the most powerful way to convey ideas. Oh, and man. So I'm going to catch up on my video backlog, but I want to just like focus on doing more pure art as like a main, you know, hobby for Wiki World Order.
To spread ideas.
Yeah, yeah, and
make them a vessel.
Yeah, because yeah. I feel like, you know,
mainly film stuff.
Yes, I think mostly visual, but I also want to do music and more music, because, you know, I've been toying with it, but I haven't really worked at the skills very much yet, you know. And I've started playing cello again at the farm, though, so that's excellent.
Cool.
And wherever I go, I think I'm going to need to travel with that, so I'm glad it's coming home.
What's the farm?
The farm in Sacramento, out by the airport on a golf course. So it's called Full Circle Farm, and the legal owner... David Tat Chow lived there for 38 of his 42 years, and and his parents were, you know, busted for a few pot plants 20 years ago and like held in prison for a while, and he had to fight just to keep the farm from like drug forfeiture laws and stuff.
Wow.
And but he kept it, yeah.
And now it's a farm, but it's not a pot farm.
Well,
what?
Well, it was that too, but
it was, but
that
now.
Never left. But or I mean that, I mean it, in California it's legal. I mean, like, we had scripts, and then, you know, so it, and the new owners have it now, so it's in there. It's all theirs.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Like the bank finally foreclosed on him, and despite the ongoing legal suit, and they had an auction. With only one person there, and I've come to the conclusion that, you know, these folks are a lot rougher than I'm used to dealing with, because when we finally, you know, showed up and got our property out, and during a time scheduled with the new owner, and then he canceled at the last minute. 15 of us who were planning to go showed up anyway. Because we needed to get our stuff out. It had been 11 days since we had been suddenly evicted without the usual 7 days notice. And so it was pretty bizarre. And then that night, the house burned down. And that's too much coincidence. I can't be a coincidence theorist on that. So.
Wow, that sounds pretty crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, like, majority of my, like, physical possessions, like, burned down in the house that burnt down. But, like, the house was so beautiful. And, like, Tad grew up there. So there was, like, a loss in that respect. Like, it was more of a material cleansing for me, like, because of where I'm at anyway. You know, like, some art and yearbooks are irreplaceable. But the rest, if I want to, it is. You know.
Yeah. So you're still there, and there's occupiers there, and you're...
Well, no, we're out. We're done. And okay. I've been staying with one of my friends from Occupy Sacramento and the farm.
Yeah.
And I'm doing that for this next month, at least, and I'll probably travel around and see some friends and some other occupations. Mm-hmm. But
so you used to work with Students for Sensible Drug Policy?
Yeah.
And that's based in California, right?
It's more based in D.C., but we have a California office, too.
Cool. How was working on that, and anything you want to say about it?
Sure. I mean, I started my chapter of the Students for Sensible Drug Policy at the University of Maryland in 2002, right after getting arrested, right after 9/11. Like, it was the wrong time to start a drug policy chapter. all the proper hippies who were activists, too, like... We're on the anti-war stuff, and I didn't play in them. I supported it, you know. Drug war just touched me, and, you know, I already had programming jobs. I could afford to blow a grant on a lawyer, and it was PG County, which is, you know, much different demographics. And I was my friend and I were some of the only white people in the courthouse there on drug day, and we were the first to go because we had lawyers and stuff. And I just felt the system just consuming people, you know, and I felt how lucky I was. So, you know, that's why I and then I read a bunch about it, and, you know, I just feel like, you know, as far as, like, mainstream dialogues go, the drug war is the biggest civil rights issue of our generation, you know, as it's built up over generations and had compound, you know, punishments to told classes.
I feel like in some regard we're trending in the right direction there. There's evidence of things loosening up in certain more progressive areas.
Yeah,
But I think it's definitely segmented to very specific socially acceptable, more so socially acceptable drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's encouraging, but I don't think it's really enough or based on the right kind of principles or perspectives and that. I'm still really disheartened about the state of that here in the States.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. There's a... Maybe it's Brazil or Ecuador that recently... I mean, there are actually a lot of places in Central and South America who are having talks right now about loosening up
their
drug policy.
They're starting to get outraged.
Yeah, because they see the war on drugs is not working.
Yeah.
And they're ready to try something new.
Yeah.
And they're looking over at places in Europe who have laxer laws and don't have a war. Don't have all this death and all this money spent.
It's
and
amazing.
It's logical to them.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, let's try something different. Yeah. And I think the U.S. is kind of trying to strong-arm them into not changing policies.
Yeah. They definitely want to keep it going. I don't know why. I mean, I know why. But
profit, control.
Yep, it works every time.
So, SSDP?
Yeah, so after my chapter, I quickly got involved with the national office because I live in Maryland real close, and I ended up, years later, taking over the national website. And it was designed by Micah Daigle, one of your our mutual friends.
Yeah.
And so we worked very closely on it for 3 years, and that's why we're really close. And I mean, that's how we started getting really close. But and that was a great experience. You know, that that website was run off my homemade content management system, you know, that I started building, I guess, in 01 or 02. It sort of had like a WordPress kind of vision in terms of a user experience for managing their own website. I pictured it being a little more like visual, but I'm sure like it'll all get there soon enough, and I wouldn't have done it very well. But
has SSDP had any really notable victories?
Gosh, well, one of my favorite ones is if I remember correctly, I've been a little out of the loop in the last few years, and intentionally as I try to get back away from the woods a little more. But the Bong Hits for Jesus case.
What? Tell me more.
That was like, it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and I can't remember enough of the details. It was some kind of sporting event, and there was a big sign held up that said Bong Hits for Jesus, and it became a big free speech issue. And
people get arrested.
I think so. I don't know. I'm too rusty. I'm sorry.
Okay. I'll look it up.
That's one of the funner ones.
You mentioned Michael. I mean,
Micah. Yeah.
Are you familiar with Upgrade Democracy?
Yes.
Site that he launched on, I guess it was
actually
January 11 or so.
I might have, see what that looks like. Yeah, I set that up for him.
You did this?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So before I ever met Micah, and this is probably during early Occupy stuff, I came across this.
Oh, cool.
I found it really captivating, and I was like, oh, this is awesome, and then somehow I got connected with him. So
cool.
Just for people listening, it's upgradedemocracy.org, and it says basically, your democracy is out of date. Last update, June 21st, 1788. Neglecting to update your political operating system will result in corruption, poor government performance, and further loss of national integrity. And this is drawn like an alert on your computer. It says upgrade. So basically, the Dynamic Democracy Initiative is working to make our democracy more connected, effective, and accountable. We envision a future in which we represent each other on the issues we know best, rather than politicians calling the shots. We're just getting started, and there's lots of work to be done, so connect with us and find out how you can help. So I highly recommend anybody listening go and check out the site upgradedemocracy.org. It's good stuff. Very informative. And, of course, like and share it with your friends if you dig it. But, back to what...
Yeah, I love Micah's design. Like, it's so fun to work with them. I'm really good with the functionality and stuff, and it's so nice to work with Mad Rescue too. I work with designers that are just superb, and they make all my stuff look really sexy, and it's fun. Mm-hmm. So every time I work with Micah, it turns out nice.
He's got a new thing, Crowdcamp.
Crowdcamp.
Have you seen this? It's really cool. So basically, he's looking at examining the crowdfunding model, mm-hmm. and creating basically like an incubator for crowdfunding projects.
Cool.
So like, they're gonna bring in some of the basically most successful crowdfunders who have had Kickstarter projects that mm-hmm. made like hundreds of thousands mm-hmm. of dollars. They're gonna bring them to this place. You apply with your idea. They're gonna coach you and walk you through kind of really accelerating your idea to be beyond successful.
Wow.
And I think it aligns really well with, the other day I put a post up on Facebook basically with my own personal mission statement, and I asked some other people to chime in, including Micah, and his was to really, really eloquent, and compared to mine, which was quite verbose, but he said, to increase entropy in the universe by increasing agency here on Earth now. Something like that.
Cool.
Which is,
sounds like a Micah thing.
Yeah. So
very cool.
So Crowdcamp seems like it will serve that mission pretty well. And I'm interested to see what happens with that. You mentioned you're going to Burning Man.
Yes.
Excited?
Yes, finally, like, as it gets closer, you know.
Have you been before?
Yeah, this will be my 6th year. And I do love it. Like, I felt welcome home as soon as the first weirdo said it to me, you know. And feels like, compared to the Rainbow Gathering, which I did not experience enough to really get a feel for, it felt like a different version that's like on the moon or something, you know, like mm-hmm. like where the Rainbow Gathering was very natural and a little less, like a little more organic, nice little structure.
Here's a good illustration of the difference, I think, probably. Rainbow Gathering, we had people who went in before the gathering and dug 6 foot deep latrines for toilets.
That was the big difference.
With, like, covering. you go to Burning Man, I haven't been, but I'm pretty sure they truck in porta potties.
Yes, yes.
So, yeah, since you're going, you should, I don't know if you're familiar with this events group in Atlanta called Area 51.
Okay.
But they have a camp there this year.
Okay,
and
cool.
And Alex and Allison Gray are staying with them.
Oh, wow, awesome.
I don't know if they're going to be there the whole time.
Right on, yeah, nobody is anywhere the whole time.
Go.
Cool, good to know.
I think they're doing some workshops and stuff.
Cool.
But, cool, well, thanks. Anything else you want to touch on?
I don't know, not...
Oh, let's talk about the future.
Okay.
Technology, specifically.
Okay, cool.
So I'm looking at a lot of things, and a lot of things are on my mind. One thing that I'm really interested in is the next-gen computing devices that we're going to see emerge in the next over the next 5 years and then like 15 years. Mm-hmm. And what I'm fascinated by is the emergence of this conversational user interface. You know, mm-hmm. we have Siri. And we have Google's voice search,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and I think Amazon's looking to get into like the handset device market,
wow.
and I'm sure they're going to try to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the implications for this are really huge, I think,
mm-hmm.
because what happens when the fundamental way we compute changes such that you no longer have to be literate
mm-hmm.
to search,
cool.
to access the world's information.
True. Yeah.
And simultaneously, we have millions, billions mm. of people in the world who are yet to be connected to
mm-hmm.
the internet and the global brain that's emerging.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when all those people start coming online and lots of them can now mm. engage in that who don't even have to be literate? That's a pretty big paradigm shift.
Mm-hmm.
And we see trends towards this, like, for instance, average search query steadily increasing, exponentially, actually, mm. over time. Moving more towards like natural sentences, natural verbal language, instead of, you know, like you type and you parse it out into
little
focus.
How will Google? How do I search Google best? It's getting more just like ask.
And so these next gen devices like Google Goggles,
mm-hmm.
and then you know future wristwatch, you know mm-hmm. that you talk to that syncs with your phone.
Mm-hmm.
They're gonna have you know Siri or Google Voice Search or the equivalent from mm-hmm. whatever maker, and. I think this is a really positive thing, but something I'm really concerned about that coincides with this is, so Eben Moglen has a wonderful talk. He's working on a project, Freedom Box. I believe that's the name for it. But he has a wonderful talk called Innovation Under Austerity, where he talks about the history of the internet and open source technologies and PGP and the... basically the corporatization of the web
mm-hmm.
and how this is inherently a really bad thing for the web and for information. And it's I think it's a really like landmark talk. I think everybody should listen to it.
Mm.
But to to bring that full circle, what I'm really concerned about is these corporations like Apple and Google and Amazon holding silos of all this voice interaction.
Mm-hmm.
So you have billions more people sharing their every thought, every search, query, every... eventually persistent listening.
Mm-hmm.
Your computer's
mm-hmm.
constantly going to be listening. You're going to choose to because the utility will be so great because it'll pick up on cues on what you're saying and automatically cache information for you to
mm-hmm.
reference later when you talk about the whatever, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is all going to be in siloed servers.
Some of that to
servers.
Learn from itself.
And I think there's something to be said for, you know, private innovation definitely. I think private industry can drive innovation, but I think, I mean, I'm all for a more open world. I want to see everything opened up, and information should be accessible by the commons.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really, really concerned about the biggest fundamental technological shift in our time, in history,
mm-hmm.
to this conversational user interface that changes so much, being capitalized on in such a way that's like not allowing full innovations. Because imagine how much more useful it is if we own that data.
Mm-hmm.
If you own your voice
mm-hmm.
query data.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's something I've been geeking out on, trying to think just how.
Yeah.
That's a really pressing issue. I feel
and it's one like on the spectrum of paranoias and like things to stress over. It's like we could worry about it now already. It's like we've already got wired devices. They've already got silos. Like
right.
if they want to be recording it, they could. But it is. I don't know. I think out of the various like races to get people over to like I don't know what word to use, but like a righteous side of some of these paradigms. You know, I feel like the openness of the internet is one that people seem to be picking up a lot faster than a lot of the other, like, equally abstract. I mean, that's a pretty fucking abstract concept. Like, the internet's tough for a lot of people over a lot of ages, and like keeping the internet open, that's like, that's a tough concept. So I think it's impressive that like we've been able to have some public pushback on stuff like SOPA and PIPA and ACTA to the extent we can, and to the extent it's effective in the long run. But
mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's encouraging.
Hmm.
So hopefully, you know, like hopefully by the time it gets there, like basically my vision for the solution or the win is, you know, Linux systems just like taking over the first place, you know, at least as like a tipping point,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then at least it's better than like politics right now, where like a third party is usually less than 5% of the users. Linux machines fucking rule the world already. Like, just consumers don't use it much, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so once a few more like pieces of software get written for that, then I think people will be ready. I hope.
Sorry.
It's cool. It's cool.
I was looking at my favorites on Twitter from today, looking for something that I saw. I can't find it. But what I want to talk about is somebody like recently wrote. I don't remember his name because I can't find the tweet or article just in the last couple days. I think about some very fundamental web concepts in a major publication, and had the concept of even like what the internet is completely wrong.
Mm.
Like, he was basically confusing Ethernet with the internet.
Huh.
And like credited the creator of Ethernet for the internet, and saying that,
whoa.
That government couldn't be credited for I guess it's ARPANET and for the emergence of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Because this other person had created it, who was working for like Packard or something, or I don't know.
Huh.
But it's just interesting that even you know, people who are supposed to grok this stuff and sort it out and tell it in a way that the public can understand are getting it so wrong that they credit, you know, the complete wrong person and the wrong technology, and completely misunderstand what the internet even is.
Yeah,
confuse it with Ethernet, and then confusing the web, which is like the layer top of the
mm-hmm,
internet,
mm-hmm.
With other various technologies, and I think it's important that people understand that the internet is not a place or a thing.
Mm-hmm.
The internet is a set of agreements. It's a set of protocols
mm-hmm.
that basically just says, when they designed the internet, they said, we're going to design protocols that say, what is the fastest, most efficient, most resilient way to get this bit of data
mm-hmm.
from A to B,
mm-hmm.
or from C to F, you know, and to route it there. That's all it is.
Yeah,
it's that agreement.
Yeah.
And as long as you're a node connecting to the network, the internet, then, you know, you agree by the protocol and you work with that protocol. And that's what the internet is. And the web is a layer on top of that. And the World Wide Web is a total different protocol or technology on top of the internet. And it's so interesting just to see that explained so wrong.
it's not a truck. You can't just dump stuff on it. But what do you... I haven't done enough digging into mesh networks.
Oh.
Have you checked that out yet? And how close do you think we are?
Yeah. Okay, so it's something that's been on my radar for a while, and there are definitely like huge hurdles to overcome. And I don't have enough technical proficiency to say whether I know if it's really doable or not. But the first week of Occupy Wall Street, I was on a committee of sorts trying to, of the more kind of tech-savvy folks who were concerned with network issues and user sovereignty on the network and things, and drafted a proposal within that first week of, like, our intentions to move forward with trying to secure a secure wireless for Zuccotti Park, and as well as some visioning for, like, where we wanted to go with tech stuff, with building some, or at least educating people who were within the network on how to use PGP and things like that.
Cool.
And through that, I met Isaac Wilder, and he's working on with the Free Network Foundation.
Cool.
And so what they're doing there is they're working on mesh networks. And so in Zuccotti, they deployed what they called the Freedom Tower. Did you see or hear of this?
I don't think I did.
So it's basically a mobile, you know, deconstructible, reconstructible tower with some broadcast antennas on the top and several clear hotspots. And the clear hotspots then were routed through a hacked router that basically had a software stack running on it. That would encrypt communications and do all these other like interesting network things.
Holy shit.
Yeah, and so then it gave the park Wi-Fi. The issue, of course, that we ran into was the police took the generators that we needed to run.
Generators.
And they, I think they were running it off batteries for a while. Of course, I left the park and came back to Atlanta like a week later. But so that's probably like the closest connection to someone like working on mesh network stuff that I have, and they're working away very diligently, and I don't know, it'll be interesting to see what they can do. I mean, I know they're working on the hardware end as well as like the software stack and the network side, and they have this other part of the recipe that, so they have the Freedom Tower, which would be deployed like at a neighborhood scale, right? You'd have a Freedom Tower in your neighborhood that would broadcast Wi-Fi to all your neighbors, to your immediate local community. And then, and the goal here is community-owned network. Like, that's what you want, is co-op networks. And then once you have enough and you have density, you can make it into mesh network. So the idea is to piggyback on the current existing network infrastructure, like clear hotspot, you know. And the reason they chose clear, in case you don't know much about clear, is that clear has the most, I don't know if the word would be ambivalent, data kind of approach. Like basically, I don't know if that's the right word, but your bits are your bits, and they don't touch your bits, they don't meter your bits.
Got it.
And whereas like the Sprint mobile cards don't do that. So then the other part component to, other than the Freedom Tower, is the, I guess it's the Freedom Node, which is basically this more centralized node that sits, that will sit on a more direct internet backbone link. And it'll do all kinds of, it basically plays the role of routing between, I hope I'm getting this right. I would love to, I'm going to have to just talk to him to get this out there.
Yeah.
But I think it helps route the data amongst the Freedom Towers and amongst other Freedom nodes.
Wow.
So then
cool.
if you have a set of Freedom Towers or one in Austin, Texas and another in New York, those Freedom nodes help link those two together securely, completely encrypted end to end.
Got it.
Yeah.
Got it.
So.
Cool.
Yeah.
Huh.
And I mean, I don't know much about mesh networking.
Cool.
How, you know, whether it's feasible or not.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's something we need to be working on.
Yeah, and there were local, at least local working examples at Occupy Wall Street.
Not of mesh networking, but of...
Oh, okay.
Of one... as liberated and secure an internet connection as could be managed within the constraints of the space and resources.
Got it.
You know what's interesting is... when the police raided Zuccotti Park, they took a lot of laptops in the process, including laptops that belonged to people from the Free Network Foundation, Isaac Wilder's laptop.
Wow.
And Motherboard TV, I don't know if you know of them, their website. They did a piece covering some Occupy stuff, and they're a future-oriented tech site, really geeky.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually covered Isaac and the team going to, like, recover their laptops. And the police had beaten the shit out of the laptops with baseball bats and destroyed them.
Jesus.
So, like, Isaac's basically on the blog 2 days after being like, can anybody donate me a computer? The police have destroyed mine.
Wow.
As well as, like, 10 others.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. But, yeah, so anybody listening, check out the Free Network Foundation. I think it's either freenetworkfoundation.org or fnf.org. Google it. You'll find them for mesh network stuff. And again, you can find Morgan's site at wikiworldorder.org.
Yeah.
Or is it .com?
Both. Yeah. Oh. .org. Nice.
Final note. I'm excited for Google goggles. I want some. And I'm really interested. Imagine when you can sit here and have a conversation with someone, and the camera on your Google goggles is analyzing their face in real time, and then it's giving you a little indicator in the corner that really tells you stats like their enthusiasm level, their engagement level.
Holy shit.
It, based on, like, facial recognition, or, like, gives you, like, a little yellow or red meter, or to green meter, based on, like, how truthful it thinks they're being at the time.
Totally.
I don't know.
Wow, those would be game changers. If those are standard, or, like, what people use it for most, or...
What I'm concerned about, too, is, like, the existing legal bodies that we have are so archaic and slow moving that they can't keep up
with
sensible policy for these emerging technologies.
Mm-hmm.
And kudos to the EFF for like all the work they're doing. But I mean, the average person is not aware of you know, their rights or they need to be. So.
Yeah, I feel like the Tea Party on the right and Occupy on the left, generally in the old paradigm, you know, I think we may have a lot of people surrounded. So people are starting to wake up to like just extra layers of the reality around them.
But not to be pessimistic, because
that's cool. It's
I'm
cool.
on both sides. I mean, as Eben Moglen says quite well in his Innovation Under Austerity talk, which actually they did a Q&A at the end, and Isaac Wilder was there. It was at the Freedom to Connect conference.
Cool.
Yeah, and so they did a nice little Q&A about the same issues. Like, and one of the issues that Isaac brought up was, you know, the average person every day, all they care about is convenience. So how do you win when you're trying to create open, hackable technologies when the corporate entities can create these really convenient, useful, kind of monopolistic technologies like Facebook?
Mm-hmm.
And Eben even, he totally tears Apple and Steve Jobs a new one in his talk, and some people got kind of outraged about that, but he even argues that Apple, yes, it created, like, these beautiful devices and pushed a lot of things forward in terms of usability, mm-hmm. but it pushed things in a very undesirable direction in terms of locking things down. And he really condemned Steve Jobs for that.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
How did we get on that?
Maybe Google goggles. Or
So to not to, be so pessimistic, but part of his talk and what he's really harping on is how crucial this moment is right now. That we have seen the web essentially be taken over by Facebook.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Mainly, it's Facebook at this point.
Yeah, that's the central hub right
now. It's increasing at a really rapid clip.
Yeah,
and they're on a path right now to totally revamping their mobile strategy. Mm. And they've recruited like basically all the best mobile UI UX development folks.
Mm.
Mike Matas is one of them, who formerly worked at Apple, and he's created like really amazing things. Pushpop Press is his like UX thing.
Mm.
And they made an awesome app for the iPad with Al Gore called Our World. Have you heard about that or seen?
No,
it's really cool. It's
yeah.
like innovative digital book.
Huh.
It's really neat.
Cool.
But so yeah, Facebook is times are getting crucial. We have to figure out before the next millions and billions of people hit the web for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
How to, instead of putting them in this platform that the user is the product, you know? The user only exists mm-hmm. to sell mm-hmm. to the people who are paying the bills.
Mm-hmm.
We have to figure out how to change that so that when they come online, they're getting put into a different web experience and ecosystem. And what I want to see is Mozilla's doing something really interesting with, they have Firefox Mobile. And, you know, they're kind of champions for the open web.
Yeah, yeah.
And in development, it was called Boot to Gecko. Basically, it's a web OS.
Huh.
And it runs on Samsung hardware or whatever.
Wow.
And what that'll do is it'll make really cheap mobile devices.
Cool. Wow.
And so that's hopeful.
That is.
But what I really want to see is that integrated into that is a software stack that really successfully designs the introductory user experience such that when you come online, instead of the first thing you do when you go online for the first time is like go and get your Gmail address
mm-hmm.
or your Facebook account,
mm-hmm.
you get some type of user identity that is decentralized, federated, hopefully peer-to-peer capable at some point,
mm-hmm.
and that you own. And that you control where it's hosted from, and
mm-hmm.
there's a persistent cloud user agent
mm-hmm.
that stays on for you, and then when you connect to your device, you're connecting to that user agent, and you get to choose where it is on the web, and then what information it holds about you, and then further, who accesses that information. The
mm-hmm.
same way Facebook kind of gives you a toggle to choose
mm-hmm.
how you give your information to an app.
Mm-hmm.
You need this, but more around some kind of type of open platform.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to be in place before people are going to even think about leaving Facebook.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So.
How close is, like, the... I love what you just said. How close is the Bitcoin model to that? Have you looked into that much?
Yeah. I don't know a ton about Bitcoin.
It seems your account is just a big string of gibberish and... You like have a password for it, and that's it, kind of thing.
Well, as I understand it,
this is a lot more
the value on the network, like bitcoins are generated by Bitcoin mining.
Mm-hmm,
so someone
mm-hmm.
with a computer runs an app that
goes
and mines
yeah.
for bitcoins, and it's you know churning this data, and I guess that's how it's created. And I'm not
no worries,
about Bitcoin,
no worries. That's all.
But I will say that I think interestingly. on the peer-to-peer economics side, have you heard of Freecoin or Frycoin?
Not sure, maybe not.
Let me just make sure I got the spelling right before I spit this out. It's Freicoin, and it's basically Bitcoin with Bitcoin with demurrage, which I'm not well versed in a lot of economic issues, so I wasn't familiar with what that meant at first. But I believe what it means now is it's rules on the network that prevent the hoarding of wealth. Basically, this is Bitcoin modified.
Interesting. Cool.
And they have an Indiegogo. I'm really interested in this. It's the Indiegogo page says. Wait for this to load. A decentralized, distributed electronic currency designed to address the grievances of the 99% and correct the excesses of the 1%. Basically, it's Freecoin. It's demurrage currencies. It's Bitcoin for Occupy. And the main guy behind the project is a really it's Mark Friedenbach, and he has been a very successful entrepreneur. Let's see, I'll tell you his projects because it's pretty interesting. The various hats he's worn. So Mark Friedenbach, application developer at NASA Ames Research Center, a generalist engineering physicist with a special emphasis in computer science, mechanical and systems engineering, and computational physics, including numerical analysis. Broad technical knowledge combined with a demonstrated leadership ability to creative problem-solving, skills in both strategic and tactical areas, and proven ability to master new tools and technologies quickly. Blah, blah, blah. And then he has a bunch of coding qualifications, like Django, Flask, Ruby on Rails, Python, Ruby, JavaScript, C, C++, C#, Java, whatever. I'm really interested that someone with chops of his caliber is taking Bitcoin off in this, forking it off in this new direction. Mm-hmm. And so Freecoin, something to
cool.
watch.
I'll check it out. Yeah. Also, what was your... I'd love to hear a little more about your experiences in Occupy Wall Street, spending time in New York.
Oh, boy.
If you have any, like, highlights, I know it's like...
Yeah.
I'm sure there's some epic tales, but...
I'll start from the beginning. I was in New York trying to do some photography work, and I went to an event hosted at NYU by the Yes Men. Mm-hmm. For their launching Yes Labs. So, like, I love the Yes Men.
Yeah.
I think they're
some of the
brilliant.
Best.
And their hijinks are, like, so inspiring.
Yeah.
It's such creative activism.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to this event and got to meet Andy. And there I met some local New York activists and stuff. And they were telling me, like, yo, like, 2 days from now, like, this weekend, September 17th, I believe, right? Was the date?
I think so.
They were like, there's a big protest, Occupy something, or I don't know if they even said Occupy, but I was like, alright, I'll be there. And I was really interested in taking, like, a very documentarian angle,
mm-hmm,
because
mm-hmm.
it's something I've aspired to,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's, like, one role I want to play in bettering the world, is, like, letting the truth be seen and told. And
totally.
So I showed up with a borrowed camera, actually Mon's camera. I'd taken it to New York because I didn't have enough money for a camera.
Uh-huh.
And I got there the day of, and when I got there, like, Wall Street was blockaded, and I heard, you know, everybody went to this Park Zuccotti or whatever. So I showed up, and there are people there, and I immediately started, you know, just walking around, like, taking photos and trying to kind of feel it out, not really knowing, like, what it was about or
mm-hmm.
what to think. And I started, like, talking to folks, connecting, and totally vibing with the cause and purpose, you know? It's
mm-hmm.
like, we have this corporate political corruption that needs to be squelched. Duh. Not really a controversial message. I was like, yeah, that's awesome. So I don't know if I camped out there the first night. I can't remember. I think I came back and camped the second night because I had a place to stay, and so I stayed at a friend's or whatever. But I didn't see myself getting too involved. I thought, oh, this is like a protest. It'll be over. I'm going to go home in a couple days or whatever. And a couple days in, the police come in and they pretty aggressively and violently bullied and arrested some folks. And I was right there in the midst of it with my camera snapping photos. And they even, you know, pushed me and, like, got aggressive with me. And, like, luckily I didn't get arrested. But I was able to capture, like, one of the first arrests of Occupy, which was Justin Wiedes. And he's been one of the main involved organizers, like, from the start. He actually went on, I believe, Colbert Report.
Got it.
With one of the other Occupy. So, and so... Then somehow, this is how I really got roped in. It's like my adrenaline's rushing. I got these photos, and I felt like really, I mean, I cried because I was like so just distraught over witnessing in person the things that I know happen in the world and that I know are unjust. But being there, like in the midst of it, it was a real shock. It kind of shook me.
It's amazing, isn't
it? Yeah, and I was like, well, I'm in this for the long haul. And to see such, you know, just a blatant injustice taking place for people being arrested who really weren't causing any disorder effectively or breaking any law. And so that's how I got really converted from like documentarian journalist approach to like occupier. And that photo got published the next morning on the cover of Metro NYC.
Wow.
So I stayed up all night, like,
holy
all
shit,
jittery.
That's awesome.
Like, sent in my photos and couldn't sleep for shit in the park because I was, like, not comfortable. I was, like, on cement. And then, like, no sleep in the morning. I get an email and they said, yeah, we're publishing it. I go and I look at the newsstand and like, they're getting delivered in bundles and this photo's, like, everywhere.
Yes!
It was my first time getting published and I was, like, so excited. And I wanted to just, like, dwell on that, and I really wanted to continue documenting what was unfolding there. But at the same time, there was an issue going on here in Georgia that I felt really compelled. Are you familiar with Troy Davis?
Yeah,
there was a Troy Davis march from Zuccotti that I participated in, and then I felt really compelled to come back to Atlanta. And be here because that's his execution was scheduled to happen here, and to help rally people here to occupy. So I got on like a mega bus, and I stopped and spent a night in Washington D.C. And my night in Washington, like waiting on my next bus to leave in the morning, was terrifying. And here's why: because while I'm on this bus, they're like counting down the hours. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I was about to get on the bus in New York. I was on the subway. I get off the subway and come above ground and get signal on my phone, and the first alert that I get is that they had executed Troy Davis. And I was just like really upset. So I caught the megabus and I came back towards Atlanta, stopped in DC. The whole time I'm on megabus, I'm like tweeting my like outrage. And then I get in D.C., and I'm, like, wandering D.C. waiting for my megabus in the morning, and I'm so outraged at kind of the state of the political and institutional system in the U.S. that I'm tweeting how disgruntled I am pretty boldly while I wander around D.C. alone. And that kind of was a little frightening at 3 in the morning. And I don't know if you've ever been in D.C.
Yeah,
at night,
yeah.
But it's, like, it's not really a friendly place.
No. Yeah, so, most of it is not that friendly to be in it, like, late at night. It's just, like, not that fun. Like,
I wandered to this McDonald's, and a dude, like, walked by on the sidewalk outside McDonald's. Like, he came in, and then he walked by on the sidewalk, and he had a gun visibly showing tucked in his pants.
Jeez.
And I was like walking around with my like this like thousand something dollar camera, MacBook Pro. I'm like, fuck. So I caught a bus, I came back to Atlanta, and I, you know, started trying to connect with activists here, saying like, let's occupy. And in retrospect, I kind of wish that I had not necessarily gone directly for connecting with local activists, but that I had instead just gone to like the most public place, dressed nicely, and just sensibly talked to people and tried to build momentum. Because I actually feel kind of distraught about how Occupy, how a lot of things went after that. I feel like there were a lot of, and I want to be careful about my words here because I'm definitely not knocking the movement, so to speak, but I think there was a lot of tactics that weren't very accessible or engaging for the mainstream public. And if you're trying to have a populist movement focused on this issue of corporate political corruption and dominance, it's important to stay focused. And I mean, I'll admit I had a very hard time too. I mean, we were all very strained, like sleep deprived and facing police antagonization.
Right.
But still, I really wish that some of the efforts would have been less aggressive from the activist side and been more kind of warm and welcoming and movement building. And I think that's one of the bigger downfalls of Occupy locally in Atlanta has been the loss of the populist support. And it's like, yeah, there are people who still support Occupy kind of broadly, but we're already like this southern kind of conservative place, so it's already a challenging spot to really engage people on that. But so I spent time here with that, trying to really like see it through and work on holding it together and keeping an encampment. And we faced our ups and downs, and it was really hard. And in the midst of that, I was trying to document as well. And like, it was really trying. And then I went back to New York and visited, and that's when I like reconnected with Isaac Wilder and was able to catch up on the Free Network stuff. And I actually shot like a little documentary video about the FNF for them, and then came back to Atlanta. I'm really excited to hopefully be in New York for the anniversary.
Now I realize it's happening. I might have to try to make it out there. We'll see.
But anyway, that's my kind of long-winded Occupy story.
Thank you. I've been curious.
And since then, I've really stepped away from a lot of direct action on the ground locally with community organizing efforts and physical occupation. While I think a lot of that's very necessary, I've been focused on more emerging technologies, approaches, trying to understand where technology's going and what we can do to liberate people's future tools. Because the tools define the ability to have agency. And I think the way that Occupy blossomed and spread so rapidly wouldn't have been possible without, I mean, Facebook, of course, and Twitter, and the internet. And I think it's important that future activists and people have free tools. It's difficult because I don't know what role I'm playing in that. I'm not a coder. And I'm not necessarily a designer. And I'm not a systems architect. I'm just passionate about it. As are you.
Well, you
maybe
know,
just spread the message. Be a
I mean, your music. I mean, you know, I wonder like the more you can tie it into that, because the more I feel, I don't know, the each year that goes on, I'm impressed by like the amount of new flavors of like this key information that like I feel needs to be more people's focus. And
but can't, I mean, in some ways, I feel like you can't blame people for their apathy. And there's a great TED talk about this, how the dominant culture constructs apathy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course people are going to be apathetic when we're bombarded with information. Here's the interesting thing, scientifically, psychologically, the more information we're given,
mm-hmm.
the more we are unreceptive
mm-hmm.
and shut down, and
mm-hmm.
we have these filters.
So,
and I think it's it's not so common. The people who have conviction and passion enough and the technological ability
mm-hmm.
to have filters to deal with the torrent of information and parse out the garbage from the useful.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, Malcolm Gladwell talks about his 10,000 hours to
mm-hmm.
being proficient at something
mm-hmm.
in, not the Tipping Point, but,
yeah, the other one.
Whatever. the other one. And I feel like there aren't really a lot of people who have that with information work online, with knowledge work. I mean, there are a lot of people, but, like, in comparison to the global population, it's a relatively small number of people who
mm-hmm.
really have spent 10,000 or more hours
mm-hmm.
engaged in actively seeking out diverse information
mm-hmm.
and making sense of it, and
mm-hmm.
then sharing it. And there are a lot of really good journalists who are doing it, and a lot of really bad journalists who are doing it.
Totally. The more we can mix the information with the art, whatever form it takes, like, the more it'll spread. And then another thing that always sticks with me, even though, like, I should explicitly say my goal is not to get assassinated, but the George Carlin quote of, like, who do they assassinate? It's the people that tell everybody to love each other, you know? It's the it's the Martin Luther Kings, and you know, like, so to me, in the math, at the end of the day, like, that's the most important message that, like,
mm.
and then the most radical and threatening message, really, that we can be spreading.
Ironic.
Yeah.
Love and peace?
Yeah.
Dangerous stuff. These guys, man. It's pretty radical.
Yeah.
You know, I spent a lot of time during Occupy and eventually, due to all the various injustices that I witnessed, and things like police hitting me with baton because
mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to film what's happening,
Jeez.
And having their badge numbers covered. This happened
mm-hmm.
in New York at Wall Street. I mean,
mm-hmm.
like, I'm there with my camera live streaming, and I'm, you know, trying to walk on a public sidewalk, and a line of cops is blocking me, and one of them hits me in the leg with a baton, like,
huh.
for no reason. And I'm sitting there aimed at their badge numbers, and their badge numbers are all covered. And I'm like, officer, what's your badge number? What's your badge number? And just, like, blank, cold,
wow.
dead stare.
Wow.
And after 5 minutes of badgering, like, I got the badge number. But,
badgering.
But, yeah, something that started happening throughout all of this is, I started to get afraid, and legitimately, I think, of being at risk of just not an assassination by
yeah,
any means,
yeah.
but of legal
targeting or coercion or something.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I just got a bit fearful, and I stepped back from being very publicly active and
mm-hmm.
spent a lot more time kind of focusing online.
Mm-hmm.
And that coincided with my shift in strategy, realizing that a lot of activism is inherently reactionary.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really getting to the root cause. It's
mm-hmm.
like, you know, Thoreau, you know, there's for every, like, 1,000 hacking at the branches
mm-hmm.
of evil, there's one striking at the root. And most activism isn't striking at the root.
Yeah,
it's like...
Yeah.
It's really a desperate attempt to voice. It's desperation
mm-hmm.
being vocalized is,
mm-hmm.
is what most demonstrations are and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been trying my best to, like, seek out and understand root causes and
mm-hmm.
figure out how we're going to solve systemic, really big systemic problems, economically, politically, socially. And Buckminster Fuller had this insight at one point, and that he shared, basically realizing that to change society and make the biggest impact on society and humanity, you change the tools. Because, I mean, you look at any tool that's come along, the internet, tools that enabled agriculture, you know, the tractor or the car. Look at how much they've shaped and molded society and social norms. Huge impact. So I've been thinking a lot about that and, like, toying with the idea of, like, startup life. Like, I really want to see education changed. I mean, looking at, like, future of these emerging technologies and billions of people coming online, and how can we, you know, build better systems to facilitate that being liberated, instead of protesting.
Yeah.
But protesting, I think, is important too.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Like, there's, I don't feel like there's any useless role, you know, in all
resistance.
Yeah, resistance is resistance. And we've all got to do like what we can do best at any given time, I think, you know, follow our passion, because, like, whatever we're passionate about, whatever mode of expression we're most passionate about right now is what we're going to do best right now. So, and that's, you know, that's how we get closer to that lucky timing and just perfect alignment of your creative and informational passions combining, and then hopefully, like, with the world's timing and some meme gets created, you know, and I feel like those are the tipping points we're kind of looking for right now, and it might not take much, like, you know, that's another thing that gives me a bit of hope, is just, like, the chaotic nature of this, that, like, you know, I feel like the initial conditions are already set, like, we'll eventually get there to, like, switch over to the open paradigm, you know, but it's a question, it's this race, you know.
I don't think it's a sealed deal. I think it is exactly a race, and we'll either transition or some of these existing power structures, I think, are They have more, at this point, in a lot of ways, from the technological angle, they have more resources and experience, capital, to be able to jump curves, which is necessary.
Yeah.
It's really necessary in the technological realm to look ahead and build the next generation of technology. And the second comers really lose out. You look at the iPad and the market dominance Apple has. Now, yeah, it's a superior product in a lot of ways, user experience-wise, than a lot of Android tablets and other tablet attempts. But, not to be... but also, they were first to market.
Yeah.
And they had, a year or so before anything else really came along to even challenge them. And the same is true for any other emerging technology. Google Goggles, like... Who else is about ready to launch the Goggles? No one.
Yeah.
Fucking no one. And, I mean, I'm really excited for Google Goggles, and I think they're a great thing, and I'm not dissing Google, like, necessarily as a company. I'm saying that, like, I'm for more openness, and I'm a fan of a completely different structure for how things are being built and run, and I hope we get there. But I'm not... I go back and forth between the pessimism and the optimism. Because, I mean, how can we as a community really come together and build these next technologies? And there are people working on it. There are people who are swarms that are, you know, coalescing around various initiatives and efforts. And I think interesting things are going to come out of it. But I think it is definitely, like you said, a race.
Yeah.
And I'm concerned about which, you know, force is going to be able to accelerate ahead.
For sure.
Catch people's eyeballs and information. It's a nail biter.
No joke. No joke. And that's why we do all we can, and then we don't have to feel guilty, you know? Like, you know.
Well, that's all you can do.
Yeah. It's tough not to get involved.
Alright, I think it's about time that we wrapped this
cool.
up. We've been talking.
That's some fun. Thank
and
you.
Cool, so it was nice talking to you. everybody listening, go and check out wikiworldorder.org or .com, And I'll try to put links for the rest of the stuff mentioned in show notes if I can. So, yeah, thanks for listening. And this is so corny. Stay curious.
Yes, I like it.
The end.